Rescue efforts in the Bahamas are underway, and some Bahamians are watching anxiously from Miami.
Oh. When I go back home, I do expect to see devastation. However, I do plan to encounter persons who are hopeful.
Also in Kashmir, India's communications clampdown is lifting, but not enough.
This is clearly unsustainable, that India cannot hold the state in this siege-like status.
Facebook decides which posts are offensive. It's a big responsibility. So it's looking for some outside help.
It's a new genre, I guess, of governance that we're kind of stepping into. And I think that's what's most exciting about it.
And the verdict for a French rooster on trial for acting like a rooster. Yeah, like that. I'm Marco Werman. This story is Today on the World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Good to have you with us this Thursday. We begin today with an update on Hurricane Dorian. The monster storm is now lashing out at the Carolinas. While in the Bahamas, a fuller picture of the devastation has emerged. Neighborhoods reduced to rubble, roads underwater, debris everywhere. One rescue organizer described it as apocalyptic. About 100 miles to the west in Miami, they've launched Bahama Strong. They're collecting goods and clothing to help people in the Bahamas. Kayvon Hidari is a reporter in Miami who's been following the relief effort there. Where have you been, Kayvon, with these volunteer aid efforts, and just what's the scene?
Well, I've been to a church, which is actually the epicenter of the relief efforts and the gathering of supplies and help. And it's in the Coconut Grove section of town. And Coconut Grove was the original neighborhood in Miami, which was inhabited by Bahamians. There's a lot of people coming in, bringing in supplies, trying to help, and it's become sort of a command center for a lot of people who want to do something about this. Dave Thomas is the pastor and in a church in Freeport, Grand Bahama, where much of the destruction is. He was in Miami for a medical procedure as the storm was closing in on the Bahamas, and he's stuck here trying to reach out to his friends and family.
About 80% of them contacted me back. There was a response. However, to the remaining 20%, there was no response. So I'm hopeful that they are well and in fine form at this time.
Kayvon, does Pastor Dave Thomas there, does he plan to go back to the Bahamas?
Well, he's waiting, as are many people, for government clearance, for logistics help, but he will go back when he can. And I asked him if he was ready to see whatever destruction, whatever was left of Grand Bahama Island.
Oh, when I go back home, I do expect to see devastation. However, I do plan to encounter persons who are hopeful as well. Persons who, yes, know the circumstances that we've been in, but also persons who are willing to come together to work cooperatively with each other by sharing and caring and with acts of kindness to build or rebuild a better island, a better country.
Wow, he seems super positive, Kayvon. I mean, is that really the feeling you get from most of the people, like Bahamian expats you've spoken with in Miami? Because some of the stories from the Bahamas right now are just gut-wrenching.
Well, many of the people have that impetus that comes from trying to help. Of course, it's one thing being outside and another being on the island and not knowing what your immediate and long-term fate will be. But there is a good feeling, and there's a lot of people who are looking to help, and there's a machinery that has been set up in other relief efforts, perhaps Maria in Puerto Rico, Irma, that is kicking into action again.
The part of Miami where you're at, Coconut Grove, I did not realize has this deep connection to the Bahamas. What is the history?
Well, there were many Bahamian immigrants that were brought in to build the city of Miami. The neighborhood is within walking distance of Miami City Hall. And the priest at the church, Jonathan Archer, was previously stationed in the Bahamas, and now he's the head of the epicenter of the Organization for the Help to the Bahamians. And so it hits home for him.
Our church is a church that has Bahamian heritage. It was founded by Bahamians, and many of the congregants are Bahamians, third and fourth generation, and they have family in the Bahamas. And the response has been wonderful, and we're happy. I'm so happy and pleased with the response. The donations are coming in, and they will go a long way to help those who are in need.
Miami and Coconut Grove coming to the aid of the Bahamas. Kayvon Hidari doing the reporting for us in Miami. Kayvon, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Marco.
In Afghanistan, the Taliban have launched a wave of attacks this week. Suicide bombers in the capital, Kabul, leaving a trail of grief. Elsewhere in the country, full-scale military assaults launched by the Taliban on several regional capitals. Dozens dead, and all of this taking place as a peace deal was announced in principle Monday between the U.S. and the Taliban. Yesterday, the Afghan president's running mate, Amrullah Saleh, denounced the deal in a stump speech.
Taliban, Amerikayanu ta wayli di.
Saleh called the U.S. Taliban deal a conspiracy. It is not peace, he said. It is aimed at the division of Afghanistan, and we do not accept it. Nine former U.S. ambassadors have published a memorandum to also share their concerns on the website of the Atlantic Council. Ryan Crocker is one of them. He served as ambassador to both Iraq and Afghanistan. Welcome back to the program, Ambassador. Why are so many Afghans, like the politician we just heard from, why are they so concerned?
The condition that the Taliban set for conversations on a peace agreement years ago now had at the top of the list that they would negotiate only with the United States, not with the government of Afghanistan, which they considered a puppet regime. After refusing to meet that condition for years, the Trump administration decided early this year that they would accept it. And that's how the talks have been unfolding since, not between the Taliban and the government of Afghanistan, but between the United States and the Taliban. That delegitimizes the Afghan government. That is why you see a statement like this from Amrullah Saleh, a sentiment held by millions of Afghans.
And do you share those concerns, Ambassador?
Absolutely. I have likened this current process and this effort to reach an agreement with the Taliban by the United States as very reminiscent of the Paris peace talks to end the Vietnam War. Before we sat down to the table, it was already clear that these were surrender talks, and it is the Afghan government and the Afghan people that are going to pay the price.
In the piece you wrote, Ambassador, with eight other former U.S. ambassadors, you say that it is not even clear whether peace in Afghanistan is possible, which is in itself kind of a stunning statement. But you also say a major troop withdrawal must be contingent on a final peace. So if peace is elusive, how long will U.S. troops stay in Afghanistan?
We need a right-sized force, which I think we have had now, and a long-term commitment. There's not a high price to pay, neither in blood or in treasure. I would see it as a pretty good insurance policy against a return, say, of 9/11 to maintain that presence as long as we need to.
And a return to 9/11, i.e. an oasis, a safe haven for terrorists and extremists to kind of plot.
Well, that's the key security point in all of this. The Taliban is no kinder or gentler than they were prior to 9/11 when they ran that country. They seek to run it again. So when they come back, it's a pretty safe bet. Al-Qaeda will come back with them. We've seen this movie before. And to set the stage for what we saw on 9/11, to me, is incomprehensible and indefensible.
All that despite the pledge in the deal to break the alliance with Al-Qaeda.
The Taliban will say anything we want them to say right now, because they know once we go, we're not going to come back.
There is a next step in this peace deal, as I understand, and that would be the Taliban negotiating with the Afghan government. Does that encourage you?
Not at all. Once we have signed our surrender agreement, our withdrawal agreement, the Taliban is not going to concede anything to the Afghan government. And frankly, I would be surprised if those talks ever take place.
Ambassador, we're just days away now from another 9/11 anniversary. What was it like writing this opinion piece, knowing what the roots were of this war?
Well, it was frankly heartbreaking. I saw my life change, as so many others did, on 9/11. Within several months, I was in Afghanistan to reestablish our embassy. On the 11th of March, 2002, we held a ceremony around the flagpole at the American embassy, the other side of Ground Zero, if you will, to mark that sad occasion. And also to state our determination. We were in Afghanistan. We had brought down the government that harbored the terrorists. We set out initiatives, again, very early during my tenure there, to bring Afghan girls and women back into society, girls who'd been denied education when the Taliban came to power. We're now walking away from all of that. We are walking away from the Afghan girls and women that we urged to step forward, saying, we've got your back. Well, we don't have their back anymore. They'll pay the price, not us. But looming behind all of that is, again, we're setting the stage for exactly what happened on the 11th of September, 2001, and it is very painful to watch.
Finally, Ambassador, supporters of the Taliban are tweeting that they've won the war and defeated the United States, just like the Mujahideen beat the Soviets. Do you see it that way?
They certainly haven't defeated us militarily. We remain the most powerful force on earth. But unfortunately, the rush for the exit that this administration has decided on allows them to put that out there, that they stood against the United States just like they stood against the Soviets. And again, very much as the Viet Cong and the North Vietnamese were able to say in Paris. So it's a pretty sad moment. Again, our military certainly didn't lose a war. The politicians just got tired of it and said, let it go. And that's what we're doing. We'll pay the price for that down the road, as will the Afghans.
Ryan Crocker, one of 9 former U.S. ambassadors who have published a memorandum to express their concerns about the draft deal between the U.S. and the Taliban. Ambassador, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Let's catch up on British politics now. The parties that oppose Brexit are using every conceivable maneuver to stop Prime Minister Boris Johnson from allowing the UK to leave the European Union on October 31st with no plan going forward. The divisions are stark. Still, today, Prime Minister Johnson said Brexit is actually the way to unite the country.
The longer this goes on, the more dither and delay we have from Parliament, inspired, I'm afraid, by Jeremy Corbyn, the worst this thing will be.
He's throwing his main political rival, Jeremy Corbyn, under the bus there. When Johnson was asked if he'll go back to Brussels seeking a new Brexit deal, he said,
I'd rather be dead in a ditch.
So you would resign first, Prime Minister, rather than go and ask for that delay?
I really, it costs £1 billion a month. It achieves absolutely nothing. What on earth is the point of a further delay? I think it's totally, totally pointless.
The Brexit drama has become a family affair for the Prime Minister. His brother, Joe Johnson, is also a member of Parliament and a member of the same party, the Conservative Party. Joe Johnson resigned from government today. He does not agree with his brother, the big boss, on Brexit. He said he was, quote, torn between family loyalty and the national interest. And that's about it, really.
I haven't got any further comments to say other than it's been an honour to be MP for Orpington and a minister under 3 governments. But it's time to move on and I've got to get to work.
The party?
Sorry, I beg your pardon.
Are you completely at odds with your brother, Mr. Johnson?
Right. See you, folks.
Right. See you, folks, he says there. Okay, shelve this one in the oops section. Canadian author Margaret Atwood's highly anticipated sequel to The Handmaid's Tale accidentally ended up in the mailboxes of some Amazon customers ahead of its release date. Booksellers around the globe had been forced to sign a strict embargo agreement to keep the book under lock and key until next Tuesday. And now those bookstores are steamed, to put it lightly. Amazon says it was a mistake that the books were shipped to some pre-sale customers. Atwood waited 34 years to publish the new novel, The Testaments. This week in London, it was already shortlisted for the prestigious Booker Prize. I love it when literature makes the news. Coming up on the show, Facebook turns to some outside help to keep offensive posts offline. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Every day in many places around the globe, Facebook has to make difficult and sometimes hugely consequential decisions about what images and posts can stay on its platform and what gets taken down. The company says it does not want to make those decisions alone anymore and is testing out a new idea to moderate content. The World's Lydia Emanuelidou reports.
A few years ago, Norwegian writer Tom Egeland logged onto his Facebook page and posted a photo
of the so-called Napalm Girl.
Napalm Girl, as it's widely known, is one of the most iconic images captured during the Vietnam War. In it, a young girl, naked, tears in her eyes, screams in pain as she flees a napalm bomb attack. In 2016, Eglint posted the image to his Facebook page, along with several other photos that he felt had changed the history of warfare. Within hours, Facebook took it down and kicked him off the platform. It said the photo violated its rules on nudity and that in some countries, the photo might even qualify as child pornography.
I was definitely surprised and upset because this is an iconic photograph which has nothing to do with nudity or child pornography. It is a historic photograph.
When Norwegian media picked up the story and posted about it on Facebook, they too were censored for uploading the image. Even Norway's prime minister had her post removed when she tried to chime in. To Eglint, Facebook was acting like a godlike super editor based in California, his words. When he reached out to the company to appeal, he got the same canned response from some nameless Facebook employee that his post had violated their rules.
You know, it felt pretty hopeless. It didn't really matter to me that I was banned. I can live without Facebook. But I felt, you know, fighting a system where nobody listened.
Eventually, Facebook did listen. After a wave of media attention and a global protest by users, the company reversed its decision. It acknowledged the historical importance of the image and the value of letting users share it. Facebook has to make decisions on posts like this one almost every single day. Many of them, though, don't start with well-meaning Norwegian writers, but with bad actors using the platform to cause harm. Last year, during a tense hearing on Capitol Hill, Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg admitted that his company hadn't done enough to prevent that.
And that goes for fake news, for foreign interference in elections, and hate speech. We didn't take a broad enough view of our responsibility, and that was a big mistake. And it was my mistake, and I'm sorry.
Facebook recognizes the consequences the decisions it makes can have on people's safety, on democracy, on speech. And it says it doesn't want to make them alone anymore. So it's testing out an idea that some say will have the company operating more like a government than a private corporation. This idea started with Harvard Law professor Noah Feldman. It came to him while he was visiting California last year.
I went for a long bike ride up in the hills behind Palo Alto, and it suddenly occurred to me that Facebook could really benefit by borrowing the model that constitutional courts use.
He thought, what if there was some sort of independent body that users could turn to challenge Facebook's decisions, a panel that would advise Facebook on its policies? He took the idea straight to Facebook.
And I discovered, to my great interest, that Mark Zuckerberg, had himself been thinking for a long time about different ways to devolve power, create accountability, put some kinds of decision-making outside of the company.
A few months later, Zuckerberg debuted the idea on the Vox podcast, The Ezra Klein Show.
You can imagine even some sort of structure, almost like a Supreme Court or appeals board that is made up of independent folks who don't work for Facebook, who ultimately get to make the final judgment call on what should be acceptable speech in a community that reflects the social norms of and values of people all around the world.
Facebook wants to have this Supreme Court-like panel up and running by the end of this year. In the meantime, it's been doing its homework, consulting experts, holding input sessions and simulations all around the world to figure out what the board should look like and how it should work. It doesn't have all the details sorted out, but it's envisioning something like this. A 40-member panel, they'll be outsiders, not Facebook employees. They'll take on appeals from users who disagree with decisions made by Facebook. Using the company's community standards as a guide, the board will issue binding decisions on what should happen to whatever piece of content they're reviewing. This will be tricky work. The board will have to navigate vastly different cultural norms and regulatory environments. That's a challenge Facebook's Mackenzie Thomas says the company is embracing.
It's not like we have a governance system that governs the entire world, but Facebook has 2+ billion users. And it's a new genre, I guess, of governance that we're kind of stepping into. And I think that's what's most exciting about it.
Facebook knows that a 40-member board won't be able to address the concerns of all those 2-plus billion users. So it'll have to be picky about the cases it does take up.
Hopefully they would be representative of larger issues that are plaguing content moderation today.
Myanmar is one example Thomas gave me. There, Facebook is accused of playing a role in the brutal violence against the Rohingya Muslim minority by allowing hate-filled posts and false information to run rampant on its platform. Facebook has since admitted that it didn't have enough people with the language skills and cultural understanding to deal with what was happening in Myanmar. Nicholas Suzor is concerned the oversight board will have similar issues. He teaches law at Queensland University of Technology in Australia.
One of the challenges that Facebook's facing here is how does it make sure that the people who are on the board are sufficiently cognizant of the cultural contexts and the power imbalances of the people whose cases will come before them. I think this is something that Facebook still needs to work through because ultimately you can't create a board that is sufficiently representative of the 2 billion people who use Facebook.
Facebook knows this. That's why the company says it's working on a roster of experts that the board can turn to for input on specific cultures and regions. They also want a regional representative present for deliberations. Suzor doesn't know how all of this will work, so he's a bit skeptical. But in general, he's optimistic because he thinks this will address one of the biggest problems in content moderation.
The decisions are made usually in secret by people that we don't know and we don't have any real visibility into that process.
When it makes a decision on a particular piece of content, the board will issue a written statement explaining its opinion. And if it recommends a change to Facebook's policies, the company will have to respond publicly in writing.
This is kind of a compromise situation. It's not like Facebook is giving up all of its power to make the rules, but holding it more accountable by having that conversation in public, that's a really crucial part of this puzzle that brings these discussions out into the open.
Suzor says this is just one step to hold the company accountable for what happens on its platform. But it's a good step. Tom Egland, the Norwegian writer at the center of the Napalm Girl controversy, agrees. But he also wants Facebook to acknowledge that it's not just a tech company, but a media company. That's a label that would subject Facebook to actual oversight and regulation, and a label that the company has long, long resisted. For The World, I'm Lydia Manuelidou in Boston.
And it might be a good time to mention that you can connect with us on Facebook. We're at The World. Ever had a noisy neighbor who keeps you up? In France, some folks were complaining about Maurice. He's a rooster. This French lawyer says his client has nothing against roosters per se, but keep it down. Should a rooster be allowed to just be a rooster? The French courts weigh in. Still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, WGBH Boston, PRI, and PRX. Let's return to a story that topped headlines last month. Kashmir, India's only Muslim-majority state. The Indian constitution had guaranteed it substantial autonomy, but in early August, India's Hindu nationalist government revoked Kashmir's special status. To try and suppress unrest, Delhi imposed a communications lockdown on the territory. When that happened, we still managed to get through to a few people through WhatsApp.
The Valley of Kashmir has become a prison right now, because in prison you don't have facilities, you don't have markets, you don't have hospitals, you don't have anywhere to go.
I have never seen such a worse clampdown on media.
People do not have any means to communicate with each other on phone.
Today, after 31 days, India apparently is relaxing some of the restrictions on Kashmir. According to the Indian government, many phone lines are back up. Most schools have reopened. But many Kashmiris argue that things are still far from normal. Vasuki Shastri is with the Asia-Pacific program at the think tank Chatham House. So this all started on August 5th, when Article 370 was first revoked by the Indian government. What's happened in Kashmir since then, Vasuki?
I think it'll be useful to look at this in terms of what has not happened. The first thing that has not happened, which really concerned the international community, is there's been no escalation in hostilities between India and Pakistan. Listeners may recall that at the beginning of the year, India and Pakistan almost went to war after the suicide bombing of Indian paramilitary forces in Kashmir. That led to an upsurge in air warfare, but fortunately both sides decided to exercise restraint. So at the start of the month, when India took this action, there was obviously a great deal of concern about two nuclear powers going to war. But I think all of this is bluster. Both sides recognize that the costs of war would be devastating.
So what do you think this tells us about the state of India today? I mean, a Hindu-majority country, but a very large Muslim minority that feels, I think, eclipsed.
India is in the same category, you know, as Turkey, as China. You know, hyper-nationalism. We are living in an era of hyper-nationalism. I've been struck by the fact that there's so little international condemnation towards India after it carried out its act. In a way, states are able to act in a daring fashion, really recognizing that the condemnation of the international community is not going to matter much.
How much did Modi's revoking Article 370 start or maybe restart a conversation in Kashmir about independence?
There are two ways of looking at this. The narrative within Pakistan has been that, you know, Kashmir needs a referendum, that Kashmiris should decide whether they become an independent nation, whether they remain a part of India, or whether they become a part of Pakistan. That narrative has changed over time. There are a number of disaffected young Kashmiris today who, I think, if you go and speak with them, who don't like the idea of Kashmir being a part of Pakistan. But at the same time, there's a huge polarization on the ground on what independence would actually mean. What would an independent Kashmir actually look like? It's a landlocked state with very limited access to trade. So they're really in this surreal state where they're suffering on a daily basis, all the depredations brought to them by the Indian armed forces and the police on the ground. But at the same time, there isn't a leader in Kashmir who, you know, has the vision, the charisma to carry much of the state towards the idea of an independent Kashmir.
Vasuki Shastri with the Asia-Pacific program at Chatham House, speaking with us from Washington. Thanks for being with us, Vasuki.
Thanks for having me.
Fear, feelings of abandonment, post-traumatic stress. This is what some children separated from their parents at the U.S.-Mexico border have been experiencing, according to a government report that just came out this week. The Trump administration pledged to stop separating migrant families at the border last year. But as we've learned, those separations are still happening, despite a court order. WNYC's Beth Fertig has this story of a man with HIV who is separated from his three young daughters.
14-year-old Andrea remembers the last time she saw her father. They had just crossed the border near El Paso last November, together with her two younger sisters, who are now 11 and 13. Like many migrants, they were kept in a processing center run by Customs and Border Protection.
Era cerrado y hacía frío. Ahí estaba muy helado.
It was an indoor location and it was very cold.
The family had come from Honduras. They were cold, but they were still together until 3 days later when their father was taken away. It happened so fast, Andrea says they didn't have time to hug each other goodbye.
No, nada. Todo fue muy rápido.
The girls spoke to me in the offices of KIND, Kids in Need of Defense. It's a nonprofit that represents children in immigration court. The girls asked us not to use their real names because they're afraid. They're now living in Harlem with their grandmother. The Trump administration's policy of separating kids from parents ended in June of last year. But the ACLU says Andrea and her sisters are among more than 950 kids taken from parents after that date. A court agreement allows this if the parents are considered dangerous or have a criminal record. But attorney Lee Gallant of the ACLU says these new cases didn't meet that standard.
It's been traffic violations. It's been misdemeanor thefts.
And in the case of the three Honduran sisters, taking away their father appeared to violate the government's own policy.
They told us it was because of a communicable disease. We followed up and we learned that in this case, it was HIV. And we immediately said, we don't believe that that is a communicable disease that would warrant separation. We still never got a clear answer from the government.
Neither did we. HIV is no longer considered a communicable disease that can stop someone from entering the country. It hasn't been since 2010. But Customs and Border Protection has been sending mixed messages about that ever since word got out about this unusual case. In July, the agency's chief of law enforcement operations, Brian Hastings, was questioned by Maryland Democrat Jamie Raskin at a House committee hearing.
If a mother or father has HIV positive status, is that alone enough to justify separation from their child?
It is. It's a communicable disease under the guidance.
Days later, Customs and Border Protection corrected that statement. A spokesman said HIV is not considered a communicable disease that would bar entry into the U.S., nor is it grounds for family separation. But he left that possibility open. For example, if a parent could be hospitalized. That explanation angers advocates for people with HIV.
The language used is still pretty offensive and misunderstands people living with HIV.
Aaron Morris is executive director of Immigration Equality, which represents immigrants with HIV.
It really seems to presume that anyone living with HIV will be hospitalized, and because of that, they seem to justify separating families.
The three sisters say their father did not need to be hospitalized and was healthy because he took his medicine. 13-year-old Leiliana was angry when she later learned they were separated based on her dad's HIV status. They told us about that argument, she says, but I don't know what that disease has to do with us because of how it's transmitted. Leiliana pauses, embarrassed. Her older sister Andrea pipes in.
And they're supposed to help him, not to send him back to Honduras.
In February, their father was deported back to Honduras after failing to prove he had a credible fear of returning. He claimed police officers threatened to kill him and his family. His name is Jose, and we're withholding his full name to protect the identity of his family. He was at a friend's house when we called. A dog was barking outside. He was sure his HIV status played a role in being separated from his daughters last year. But he also said nobody told him that directly. To Jose's daughters, this separation was incredibly painful. Their mother died of HIV 6 years earlier. They're all healthy. After their father was taken away, they were sent to a big shelter in Texas with other children, sleeping in bunk beds. 13-year-old Leiliana says they talked to their dad on the phone twice a week while he was at his own detention center. We worried he wasn't eating or taking his medication, she says. The three of them stayed in the shelter for a couple of months until their grandmother in New York passed a background check by ICE. They're now seeking green cards through a special program for children, and their aunt has applied for guardianship. Their aunt doesn't want us using her name to protect her privacy. She says this whole experience of their dad being taken away after already losing their mother has really affected them, especially Andrea.
Sometimes you say that everything that she loves, she loses.
And what do you say to a child who's gone through that?
I say, we don't know why things happen. Only God knows. That's what I say.
In Honduras, Jose says he talks to his daughters about once a week. He wishes they could be together in New York, like he planned. I feel bad, he says. I want to be with them. I really want to be with them, to watch them grow, to talk to them, and to kiss them. League Alert, the ACLU's lead attorney in the family separation lawsuit, says it'll be difficult to bring back parents who were deported even if he can prove they were separated in violation of a court order. He'll try to seek compensation from the U.S. government. But at the end of the day, he says no amount of money can make up for the trauma this family suffered. For The World, Beth Fertig, New York City.
Next week, a federal judge is scheduled to hear arguments in the case of hundreds of families who have been separated, including Jose and his three daughters. This focus on the health of immigrants has a deep history in the United States. Gabriela Sotolaviaga is a science historian at Harvard. What stands out to you, Professor, about the story we just heard? A Honduran man with HIV separated from his family at the border.
I think the one thing that stood out to me was this mention of a communicable disease. And I think if we look back in history, how we define communicable disease and who has these diseases really shifts. And it's much more than objective medical diagnosis. It's really linked to political, ethnic, and racial groups.
So historically, if we look back at the big waves of migration starting in the early 20th century, when it comes to health, how have immigrants been perceived and treated?
If we look at Ellis Island and Angel Island, public health has always been one of the parameters for immigration. And the United States Public Health Service, since the late 19th century, was a sort of an agreement with immigration. And what they were doing was basically trying to weed out any serious diseases or mental health issues. But there were so many people arriving that these were quick checks. But if we shift our gaze to the Mexico-U.S. border, it's a completely different story. Almost exactly 100 years ago, instead of detention centers, what we had were places of sanitation. All Mexicans coming into the United States had to be deloused. And what this meant was that men and women were stripped naked. They would go into these rooms where they would be inspected to make sure they had no lice. All of their clothing and belongings were put into steamers. And it had to do with this racialization and a medicalization of Mexican bodies as opposed to other immigrant bodies. And it was this notion of really creating a differentiation between who was considered an quote-unquote alien and a dangerous body. So when we talk about what's happening right now in these detention spaces with regard to public health, this has a very long history in the United States.
More generally, more widely, how does race play into this?
So I think when we talk about race and fear of disease and immigrants, there's always been this concern that immigrants are bringing in certain immigrant-like diseases. The biggest case that comes to mind is, of course, what happened in the 1980s with Haitians and HIV/AIDS. The idea was that Haitian bodies were carriers of a specific disease and could be denied entry into the United States because of their national origin.
So that was kind of on the front edge of HIV/AIDS, and people were not that informed. Is that part of the problem?
Exactly. This was at the very beginning when it was believed that it was a homosexual disease and a Haitian disease. And that, of course, as we know, is discredited. But it's a clear example of how certain groups are targeted and certain diseases are attributed to certain groups.
So I think of some of the language used around these health issues, invasion, scourge, lice-ridden. What's the legacy of that kind of concentrated focus on the U.S.-Mexico border?
I think we are seeing the legacy of these historical attempts to racialize these bodies as significantly different. This detention of bodies is not new. It's just taken on a very different hue.
Aren't some policies, though, responding indeed to outbreaks of these new diseases?
Absolutely. And what we see, there was a lot of cooperation in the mid-20th century between the United States Public Health Service and the Mexican Public Health Service, precisely because bacteria and viruses do not respect international borders. So you really need a binational organization. But what happens in the U.S.-Mexico border is distinct in the sense that it begins to target a national group as potential carriers of specific diseases with certain traits like criminality that we're seeing with the political rhetoric of today.
Gabriela Sotolaviaga, historian at Harvard University specializing in Latin America and the border. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
I am writing with good news, said the email. The good news was that the Trump administration was offering several million dollars. The potential new millionaire was the Indian captain of an Iranian supertanker carrying oil. To get his money, all the captain had to do was steer his ship to a port where it could be seized. This would prevent Iran from making money from selling the oil on board. But the captain never responded to the email, and so the Trump administration wrote a second note, this time with some bad news. The State Department threatened to take away the captain's visa to visit the U.S. in the future. To put this into context, we turn to Holly Dagres. She's with the Atlantic Council and curates the Iranist newsletter. How unusual is this sort of email exchange? Have you ever seen anything like this before in any effort to pressure Iran?
If anything, it reminded me of these 419 emails we sometimes get about a Nigerian prince promising us millions or
right.
a member of the U.S. Armed Forces offering money from the Iraq War. So if anything, I think reading it, it was hard to believe for a moment that this was actually coming from the U.S. Department of State. And it wasn't just one incident. It was actually about a dozen where people were receiving either text messages and emails.
And there was this follow-up email to the ship captain from the State Department with a promise of, with this money, you can have any life you wish and be well off in old age, but also warned, if you choose not to take this easy path, life will be much harder for you. I mean, even the language. But I'm wondering, can this be construed as extortion, and is it illegal?
Oh, well, would an Indian national have been able to get a visa to the United States to begin with, especially if they had written on their visa paper that they are a captain of an Iranian oil tanker? So I think, for starters, I think that this person would have unlikely never gotten the visa to begin with.
Javad Zarif, the foreign minister of Iran, tweeted about the whole incident, calling it, quote, outright blackmail by the U.S. and used the hashtag B-team gangsters. Is that a smart tactic?
When he refers to the B team, he's referring to National Security Advisor John Bolton, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia Mohammed bin Salman, and the Crown Prince of the United Arab Emirates Mohammed bin Zayed. So he sees these individuals as a group that are for pressuring Iran and perhaps starting a war or some form of regime change. This is what he's arguing right now with this tweet.
So this email scheme to the Indian captain of this supertanker, it was part of a broader U.S. campaign to isolate Iran. Let's hear from State Department official Brian Hook. Here he is yesterday unveiling another effort.
We are announcing a reward of up to $15 million for any person who helps us disrupt the financial operations of Iran's Revolutionary Guard Corps and Quds Force. This offer is being made through the State Department's Rewards for Justice program.
Holly, this Rewards for Justice program, how likely is that to work?
Right before we did this interview, I was looking at their website and it was down. So if they're hoping to get tips on rewardsforjustice.net, it is not working. But looking at what they're actually offering here, I mean, if an Iranian hypothetically was to be like, okay, I have this information for you, how is the U.S. going to give up to $15 million to this person, given that they're living inside of Iran and banks are sanctioned? Are they going to protect them from the Iranian government? So I find it hard to believe, especially when it's up to $15 million, who is going to be willing to provide that information? If anything, in the coming weeks, we're probably going to be hearing about stories of spoofs and pranks of Iranians sending information to them, as they've done with other acts in recent months.
Holly Digress speaking with us from London. She is with the Atlantic Council and curates the Iranist newsletter. Holly, thanks very much.
Thank you for having me.
I cannot tell you how long I've waited for this day. Finally, the verdict is in. On the surface, this trial was about a noise disturbance, but it's become about so much more. Urbanization, cultural heritage, farm animals. The World's Sarah Birnbaum tells us about a case from a small village in western France.
There are so many things about a trial that can seize public imagination. Tense cross-examinations.
You want answers?
I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth!
You can't handle the truth!
Slam dunk expert testimonies.
There is no way that these tire marks were made by a 64 Buick Skylark. These marks were made by a 1963 Pontiac Tempest.
Stunning courtroom confessions.
I didn't mean to shoot him. I thought it was you walking through the door.
Order.
Oh my God.
But the draw in this particular case was the sympathetic defendant. Maurice the Rooster. Maurice didn't take the stand, but he was at the center of this case. Maurice was accused by the neighbors of making too much noise in the morning. So they took Maurice's owner, Corinne Fesseau, to court and demanded that she shut him up. Well, today, Fesseau and Maurice emerged victorious. The court declared that Maurice can continue to crow and ordered the plaintiffs to pay about $1,000. Fesseau told local TV that she's relieved.
I lived for bringing home a victory, and I'm very happy I was able to do it. And I'm going to say to Maurice, we won! You can stay!
The neighbors who brought the case didn't do interviews, but their lawyer, Vincent Huberdeau, said his clients aren't anti-rooster, they're anti-noise.
No, my clients don't want roosters not to sing. They want some quiet in the morning so they can sleep. And they're bothered by the rooster, just like they would have been bothered by a barking dog or a lawnmower or a car.
I know what you're thinking. Why has this generated international attention? And the reason is, what began as a battle about a bird has become a battle for France's very soul. You see, the neighbors are out-of-towners, and the house in the village is their second home, and Corinne Fessot has been there for more than 30 years. This case has become a symbolic clash between locals who want to preserve their way of life, crowing roosters and all, versus the newcomers who just want a peaceful country home. Fessot summed it up.
People who come to the countryside need to stop complaining, and they have to adapt. If they don't adapt, then they can just go back.
There's an urban-rural divide in France. We saw that earlier this year with the Yellow Vest protests. The divide is political, it's economic, it's cultural. Now, the Maurice case is a little more complicated. The neighbors aren't from the city, they're from a town in central France, and ironically, they happen to be retired farmers. Still, hundreds of thousands of people signed a Save Maurice petition. Crowds gathered outside the courthouse with their chickens and roosters in tow. And you can even buy a Let Me Sing t-shirt with Maurice's face on it. The trial is over now, but it's not clear if it's the end of the poultry drama. This week, a woman in a part of France known for duck breeding was sued by a neighbor new to the area who was sick and tired of the sound of geese and ducks in her backyard. So, defenders of Maurice, it might be time to swap your rooster t-shirt for a ducky one. For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
Keep on crowing, Maurice. From the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We'll be back with you tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, PRI, and PRX.